Welcome to the Derek Loudermilk Show. This is episode 378 with Stefan A. Schwartz. Stefan Schwartz is an internationally known researcher in the field of extraordinary human functioning. He's the former director of research of the Mobius Society and founder and past president of the Society for the Anthropology of Consciousness. He's the author of several books, including The Secret Vaults of Time, The Eight Laws of Change, and The Alexandria Project. Stefan is currently publishing in at least seven academic fields. Today's conversation is going to focus on Stefan's work in remote viewing, from when he started pioneering remote viewing and determined how non-local consciousness could be used to access information, to his work in archaeology, discovering archaeology sites around the world using remote viewing. And finally, we'll get into his massive experiments about using remote viewing to look into the year 2050 and the year 2060 to find the consensus trends that are going to be present around the world. So looking into the future and telling us what's going to be happening for humanity in the next 30 to 40 years. So you're not going to want to miss this one. Here is Stefan Schwartz. Stefan Schwartz, welcome to the podcast.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, I'm fascinated by Richard Feynman, and he has always been on my list of who I would have dinner with, someone in history that I would have dinner with. And I think I came across somewhere that you actually did have dinner with Feynman.
I did.
I was wanted to ask you about that to start with.
Well, he came to a talk I gave in Los Angeles. And afterwards, he came up and said to me, have you had dinner? And I said, no. And he said, well, let's go get some dinner. So we went out to get dinner. And actually, he told me a very interesting story. He said, I asked him, you know, how he became a world-famous physicist. And he said, well, I was kind of surprised. He said, when I was in college, I and another guy, we broke into the dean's office and we got into the files, and I opened a file on myself that had involved an IQ test, and I discovered my IQ was only 124. And I thought to myself at the time, oh, I'll never be a major physicist because I'm not smart enough. And of course, he went on to become a world famous physicist.
And he was known for playing around and doing all kinds of just off the cuff, interesting, you know, following his enthusiasm or joy. Did that come across when you had dinner with him?
No, I thought he was a very interesting guy. He came to hear a talk that I gave. I had done a submarine experiment. I've been interested for some time based on some research that I had been sent. A friend of mine was the head of the CIA, and he began sending me translations of, I don't know how they got them, I mean, I can't tell you that, of a guy named Leonid Vasilyev. And Vasilyev had asked the question that I had been thinking about a great deal, and that was a big deal at that time. We're talking about the early 70s. The general feeling in parapsychology, or a broadly shared feeling in parapsychology, is non-local consciousness electromagnetic in nature? And there were arguments about that and papers published, and a fellow named Michael Persinger at Laurentia University in Canada had published a paper that many people referred to, in which he argued that if it was electromagnetic, and he thought it was, it would have to be a part of the spectrum, the electromagnetic spectrum, called ELF, extreme low frequency, 300 to 300 hertz. But he couldn't do the experiment because the only way you could shield from ELF would be in seawater.
Hmm.
And I had gotten from this friend at the CIA had sent me this stuff from Vasiliev, who was a researcher in then Leningrad, now St. Petersburg. And he had been putting people down into caves and down into mine shafts and putting them in Faraday cages, which block electromagnetic radiation, and down in the caves or in the mines, and asked them to do non-local consciousness experiences, which they were able to do. And so he had, over a series of papers, he had published that if it was electromagnetic in nature, that it had to be ELF. And he had gone to Admiral Gorshkov, who was the father of the Soviet Blue Water Navy, Deep Ocean Navy, and asked if he could put somebody in a submarine and do an experiment, because he didn't know exactly how deep you had to get or how deep ELF would penetrate seawater. But he realized that if it was electromagnetic, it had to be ELF, because he had blocked out everything else. Anyway, Gorshkov, for whatever reason, I don't know why, wouldn't do the experiment. And I was reading all this, and I was at that point the special assistant to the chief of naval operations. And so I was reading this stuff, and as it happened, I was going to fly up to Groton, Connecticut with John Warner, who was Secretary of the Navy. And on the plane was Hyman Rickover, who was the father of the American nuclear navy and the nuclear submarines, the deep ocean missile submarines. And I asked him if he would let me go aboard one of the subs and get some sailors and to do this experiment that both Vasiliev and Persinger had been talking about, this ELF experiment. And as it turned out, because the Navy had gotten interested in ELF as a way to communicate with nuclear subs without having them come to the surface or come high enough that Soviet satellites could detect them, because they would catch the heat from the nuclear reactors. So they had spent $125 million trying to answer the question, how deep do you have to be to, I guess the question would be, at what depth can you still communicate with a submarine using ELF? And the other thing they discovered was that with ELF, you could only send a little tiny bit of information. If you remember the Quest for Red October movie, there's a scene in which they get a message like 1234, which is all you could transmit with ELF, and they go and they have a book and they open it up and they realize that ELF at 1234 represents target a particular key. So they had associated the little tiny bits of data that they could transmit with particular actions they wanted to do. They were pre-arranged. And I later got the idea for something called associated remote viewing out of this research. And in any case, so I asked Rickover if he would let me do this, just as Vasiliev had asked Gorshkov. And he said, well, let me think about it. And he called me about a week later and he said, you know, that's a really interesting experiment, but we're not going to do it. And I said, why not? And he said, well, because the media will get hold of it in some way, and they'll start talking about these deep ocean missile submarines, and we just prefer that they didn't do that. We're not interested in having people talk about these submarines, and most Americans have no idea that there are American submarines going around at depth that go to stay down for months at a time and are armed with nuclear missiles as part of the what's called the nuclear triad. In any case, so I couldn't do it. And then some years later, I got offered a fellowship in Los Angeles, and I went out to L.A. to be interviewed, and I stayed with a friend of mine who had been the deputy director of Navy Labs, and he said to me over lunch one day, you know that crazy experiment you wanted to do about with submarines? And I said, oh yeah, but never going to be able to do it. And he said, well, as it happens, we have a submarine that's coming down to do sea trials at our institute's Catalina Island facility. This was the University of Southern California Institute for Marine and Coastal Studies. And he said, and we're willing to pay for 3 days of the submarine's activities for you to do this experiment, which was amazing. So I said, well, great. And we did the experiment. You can go to my website, www.stephanaschwartz.com, and see the movie. I made a movie out of it. I got Leonard Nimoy, Dr. Spock, to do the narration. Hmm. And the task was, first, could individuals locate a previously unknown wreck on the sea floor? Because if they could, then they could penetrate seawater to a depth beyond what ELF could explain. And then, could I put people in a submarine at depth and get them to do a task, a non-local consciousness task, while the submarine was submerged and its radios were turned off? And first of all, as you can see in the movie, they were able to locate a previously unknown wreck on the seafloor. And we know it was previously unknown because the Marine Sites Board of the Bureau of Land Management keeps track of all the wrecks that are off the American coast. And second of all, we were able to put people one at a time, Ingo Swan and Hella Hammond, down in the submarine at depth, and they were able to describe where people were hiding in Northern California. And that answered the question. It could not be electromagnetic for two reasons. One is the depth at which they were, and the other is the amount of information that they were able to transmit, obtain, which was much greater than ELF would permit. So I gave a talk and showed an early version of the movie, and Richard Feynman, for whatever reason, was in the audience, and that's how we met.
Wow. There's a whole lot of really interesting synchronicities there. I have two questions. Why did it have to be at depth to assess that particular band radiation?
Well, because electromagnetic radiation generally doesn't penetrate very deeply into seawater, and ELF, which is the part that does, the Navy had spent, as I said, a great deal of money in something called Project Sanguine and then Project ELF, and so they had determined not only how deep ELF would penetrate seawater, because beyond a certain depth it couldn't, and they also determined what the bit rate of transmission could be. So how much information could you get from an ELF signal at depth? And in the case of remote viewing, when we put people at that depth and we asked them to describe things, they gave far more information than you would have been able to get from an ELF electromagnetic signal. So the conclusion is non-local consciousness, remote viewing, is not electromagnetic. There's no signal, there's no sender, there's no receiver. That's not how it works.
So as soon as you were certain that it wasn't electromagnetic, then where did your thinking go?
Well, then my thinking was, okay, I've got this, I'm studying this human ability that seemed to be spread through the population like any other human skill. That is, there are a few people that are really, really good at it, just like, you know, Arthur Ashe or Michael Jordan or something, or particularly good at sports. Well, in the same way, some people are really, really good at remote viewing. And that was one thing. And the other thing that it allowed me to answer was, okay, I can use this, and it has the ability to, distance doesn't matter, and it'll penetrate anything. And so that's what led me to begin thinking about using it in archaeology, because in archaeology at that time, this is 1977, there was a huge discussion going on in archaeology about where to look, because most archaeological sites were found serendipitously. That is, a farmer was plowing his field and he found a tomb, or a road crew was building a highway and they came across a temple. So most of the archaeological finds were just luck. And there was a big issue about that. How do you know where to look? And I thought, well, that's perfect from my point of view, because it allows us to have perfect triple blind conditions, which is the most rigorous form of research. Because, you know, it's like I found Cleopatra's palace. Well, everybody agreed that Cleopatra had a palace, but nobody knew where it was. So that's a perfect condition for what I wanted to do. Everybody agreed it existed, but nobody knew where it was, so it's pure triple blind. So if a remote viewer could locate it, as they did, then the only way they could do that was by accessing non-local consciousness, which tells us something about the nature of consciousness, and the fact that, my conclusion is that we are looking at an information phenomenon. And there are a number of reasons for thinking that. But anyway, we're looking at an information phenomena, and it's remote viewing is kind of like doing a Google search. You held an intention, and with that intention, you can access information about anything. And in fact, that's part of what scares people about remote viewing, because they realize there are no secrets. And I think a number of congressmen got freaked out about remote viewing because they realized that remote viewers could tell where their mistresses were or where they were making corrupt business dealings.
Is it? I think I heard stories that there was offensive remote viewing projects in the military. Is there defensive remote viewings? Can you confound someone who's trying to remote view?
Can you confound someone?
Can you, like, defend against it?
No.
Okay.
No. Negative. And the key to the whole business is the ability to attain and sustain intentioned, focused awareness. That's why meditators routinely do better than non-meditators. That's why they teach meditation in Japanese martial art dojos or Tibetan lamaseries or Hindu temples or wherever. All through history, humanity has come, observational science, that they recognize that people who are able to attain and sustain intention-focused awareness have the ability to open to this part of consciousness, which is not physiologically based.
So you mentioned two specific people that you put down in the submarine, and you talked about that the people in the population that were really good at remote viewing. How important to this work was it to assemble a team of quality remote viewers?
Well, I mean, it turned out to be quite important, but I wouldn't say that we knew that when we did it. I mean, I would not do classified research, and so I turned down large sums of money to do classified research for the military, because I felt that anything that we learned about consciousness ought to be shared with everybody who was interested. And so I wouldn't do it I wouldn't do work that was classified. But we didn't really understand what we were dealing with when we first began. I mean, remote viewing is a terrible term because it has nothing to do with remote and has nothing to do with viewing. It's about accessing information. So, but we didn't understand that in the beginning. I originally called it distant viewing, but that's also wrong. But what we did learn was that it was that people could remote view things that were either at a great distance or next door. Didn't make any difference. We learned that through the archaeological stuff that people could go back thousands of years in time and locate things that no one knew where they were. And we also learned that people could go forward in time and describe things in some detail that would later happen. So time and space are informational parameters, but they are not limitations. That's a very big deal.
I have a theory about how it works, and I'm going to run it by you. But first, I just want to ask, sort of nuts and bolts. When you had the idea about the archaeology, how did you get that funded, or what was the process like to begin the archaeology work?
Well, I funded it myself originally, and then the Deep Quest experiment. Part of it was funded by me. Part of it was funded by the Institute for Marine and Coastal Studies at USC. The Alexandria Project, where we found Cleopatra's Palace, Mark Antony's Palace, the Pompeii Pillar, the Lighthouse of Pharos, one of the Seven Wonders of the Ancient World. I raised the money from individuals, and I got some assistance. Five universities were involved in the work, and they helped partly with the funding, and I don't know, you just raised the money.
I wasn't sure if it was, like, I've been involved in, you know, the applying for grants on the university side, but I wasn't sure if you were part of a university at that time and had a professorship or something,
No.
But it sounds like mostly you were and have been independent.
Well, I've held all kinds of academic posts, going all the way back to being an associated professor at John F. Kennedy University. I guess that was the first one.
How important is it to be affiliated with a university or not?
Well, I don't know. I've never been, a full-time professor. Right now I'm associated with the California Institute for Human Science, and I'm a Beall Fellow, Beall Foundation Fellow. I don't know. My career is an unusual one, I guess, because I got interested in the nature of consciousness many years ago when I was a young man, and I have followed that ever since. I've held a number of other positions, like special assistant. I've been a magazine editor, that kind of thing. But I've been interested in consciousness basically since I was 24, and I just pursue it, and I do what I want to do. So it's not, I don't know. I've gotten grants from universities. As I said, I'm a Beall Foundation Fellow. I was the Senior Samueli Fellow at the Samueli Institute. I mean, I've had a whole bunch of academic appointments, but I have never, I've never taught classes at a university, or I ran a research lab, the Mobius Lab, for 20-some years. I don't know. I just do the things that I'm interested in.
Good, good. I like that. And then, okay, so I'm also curious about you're dropping these names like you were friends with the person who was running the CIA and you were a special assistant to the head of the Navy. It seems like you get access to or have friendships with important people maybe early in your career. How did all that happen? It seems kind of fortuitous or lucky or something.
I have no idea. I got to be special assistant to the CNO because they came and offered me the job. I didn't solicit it. I wasn't looking for it. In fact, I turned it down twice. I don't know. I never apply for anything. People come to me.
Okay.
They get interested in what I'm doing, I guess, and they come and say, I'd be interested in participating in one of your projects, and if I have a project, then I say, well, okay, let's see what we can do, and we do it. I don't know. As I say, it's an unusual career.
Well, I mean, that makes it a little easy, right? If people just the right people just come to you, that's quite nice in a way.
I guess I write books. I've written hundreds of papers. I've done thousands of media interviews. I don't know. I just do what I like doing, which is studying the nature of consciousness, and it just kind of goes along.
All right, I'll take that. So I was thinking about time recently and information and light and this idea that right, we can see the light from stars, but that's looking back in time. The light's arriving here, and the star might even be gone. And so we're kind of looking into the past when we see the stars. And so my question is, when you're remote viewing the past, are you somehow accessing the light that was
No.
generated at that time
No,
in a
it's
way?
not a physical phenomena. This is there's nothing that's there's not a signal, there's not a receiver, you're not looking at light, you're not looking at the transmission of anything. You're going into non-local consciousness. In 1931, Max Planck, the father of quantum mechanics, was asked by the Observer newspaper in an interview, which was itself unusual because he didn't give a lot of interviews, and some reporter came up to him and said, you and Einstein are the most famous scientists in the world. What have you learned? And I think what they expected him to say was something about atoms and molecules. But what he said was, what I have learned is consciousness is causal and fundamental. You cannot get behind consciousness. Space-time arises from consciousness, not consciousness from space-time. Consciousness is the fundamental. And once you begin to think that way and you realize that, Einstein said, what we call reality is an optical delusion. I like the delusion part. Pauli, Schrodinger, Heisenberg, most of the individuals we think of as the founders of modern physics didn't start out. They started out as materialists, but they ended up believing that consciousness was causal and fundamental. And so when you're asking someone to do a remote viewing task, they're not going anywhere. They're not traveling. There's no transmission. What they're doing is opening to the non-local aspect of consciousness, the part that is that what Planck meant by causal and fundamental, what religion calls the spirit, I guess. You're accessing that eternal part of yourself. I mean, in order to understand this, you have to look not only at remote viewing, you've got to look at things like reincarnation research done by Ian Stevenson, now Jim Tucker, Erlander Harrelson. what you come away with is you recognize that consciousness existed prior, your consciousness existed prior to your birth, and it will continue after your physical death. It's the eternal self, what religion calls the soul, but it's not about going somewhere. You're simply opening to a kind of informational unity. That's why I compare it to a Google search. The information is in the unity, but it's not anywhere in terms of physical location. It just is. The two great mystery questions for me are, what is information and what is consciousness? And I don't know the answer to either one of those questions, and I don't know anybody else who knows the answer to those questions.
So I was going to ask you, you know, when you think about where this information is,
it's not anywhere.
It's not anywhere. Okay.
No, you're still stuck in space-time, Derek. This is not about where it is. It's not like there's some sort of supercomputer that's tucked away somewhere. No, you're not. It's not about space or time. It's about information and consciousness, and the shaping of information by intentioned consciousness. And again, you look at the research. What I need to tell you is, I am a data person. I am not a philosopher. I am not a theoretician. I do not speculate. Everything I know about this is based on objectively verifiable research.
So how do you describe, how should we visualize when someone is doing remote viewing? Like, it's not aware, but it's an ever-present information field that you can just tap into whenever you need to.
Yeah.
Whenever the conditions are right. Okay.
Yeah, it's not a field.
It's not a field.
No, I think of them, for want of a better term, I think of them as informational architectures. They are arrangements of information, but it's not a structure. It's not a space-time structure. We're going to have to stop. I got to take. Hold on a minute.
Sure.
Hello. This is he. Okay. Listen, I'm doing a Zoom interview right now, a media interview. Can you call me back at about, 3:15? Okay. Thank you ever so much. Bye-bye. All right. I'm sure you can edit that out.
Sure.
The way you have to think about this, and it's difficult because all of our training is about materialism, but this is not about materialism. This is about something that is let me think how to put this. The fundamentals of reality are information arranged by intentioned consciousness. So I don't know what information is, and I don't know what consciousness is. I mean, I don't know who created it, or I think what we think of as God or gods, different religions. I'm sorry. I don't have a secretary. Hello? Yeah, I don't have a secretary in at the moment, so. It changes the whole way you think about things. You realize that once you begin to see consciousness as causal and fundamental, and you realized, for instance, that we do not have dominion over the earth as if we were somehow the recipients of a bank account from a rich uncle, but that instead we are part of a matrix of consciousness and that all consciousness is interconnected and interdependent, well, you make very different choices because you realize that the optimal way to do anything is to have it foster well-being, which is what I am most concerned with. The fostering of well-being is the most efficient, most effective, cheapest, most productive, nicest to live under, and most enduring of any arrangement or structure. So you don't, once you get that you are part of a matrix of consciousness and that it's all interconnected and interdependent, you make very different choices. You stop exploiting things, for instance. You stop polluting because you realize that what you're doing is harming not only yourself, but the entire matrix of consciousness. So you make different choices. Once you recognize that consciousness is causal and fundamental, and that there is continuity of consciousness, you realize that things that you do that create negative circumstances, you're going to come back and have to deal with that. So you'd be much smarter to make different kinds of decisions. The importance of this research, the remote viewing research, the therapeutic intention healing research, all of this consciousness research, the real importance of it is that it is telling us about how the world, what we call reality, is organized and constructed. And that once you realize that consciousness is the critical function, you recognize that you'd make different choices. You don't do things that harm harmony or balance, because when you do, you are not only harming yourself, but you're harming the future self. And so that's a stupid thing to do.
Can you give an example of once you have this framework, this decisions that foster well-being, an easy switch and maybe a more difficult one, maybe one that's harder to understand which way the decision should go?
Well, I can give you something that if you and the people that watch your podcast will do, we can change the structure of our society. We can change the outcome of the election in November. And it's very simple. Every day, you make dozens of little tiny decisions that you're hardly aware of. The soap that you buy, the foods that you buy, the toothpaste that you buy, the cat food that you buy, all of those things are essentially votes for a certain kind of reality. And if you make the commitment that from this day forward, you, Derek, as you make these little tiny decisions, will always choose of the options that are available to you, that option which is the most compassionate, the most life-affirming, and the most fostering of well-being, and you tell 10 of your friends that you're doing this as a discipline, and invite them to do it, and ask 10 of their friends, between now, which in August of whatever it is, the 15th, and November, the election, if everyone who watches this show will make that commitment and make that choice that they will only foster well-being as they understand it, every day as they make these little decisions, these what I call quotidian choices, little ordinary, mundane things they don't even think about, we can transform the world because we know that when we know from research, again, I am a data person, when 10% of any cohort changes in consciousness, the whole, whether it's a church group, a school committee, a neighborhood committee, or a nation, when 10% of the community changes in consciousness, the whole community has to accommodate for that change. And so the question is, how do you get to 10% fostering well-being? And the answer is, you get ordinary individuals to make choices of all the options available to them to always pick the one that is compassionate, life-affirming, and fostering a well-being. That's how Gandhi got independence for India without a war. I mean, think about that for a minute. When just before Gandhi was assassinated, a reporter from the Times of India came up and asked him, you know, how were you? You never held a government position. You don't have any particular money. You don't have an army. How did you force the British to give up their most valued colonial possession? And Gandhi's answer makes my point. He said it wasn't what we did that mattered, although it did matter. It wasn't what we said that mattered, although that did matter. It was the nature of our character, what I would call our beingness, that led the British to choose to leave India. So the most powerful force on earth is the collective intention of humans. And the question is, can you get 10% of the population of the United States to commit themselves to only making choices that are compassionate, life-affirming, and fostering of well-being? Because if they do, the entire society will change. Everybody will be happier. They will be, there will be more equality. There will be gender equality, racial equality. People will be more comfortable economically. I mean, pick any outcome you want, and you can prove this. This is not a theory. If you look at, for instance, the social outcome data of the red states compared to the blue states, you will see that the red states are always inferior. Why? Because the choices that they make do not foster well-being. They are about something else. They're about making a small group of people very rich, or keeping another group of people in power, or whatever. It's not about well-being. And when you look at the blue states, which are not far from perfect, but that generally tend to make social policy choices which are more fostering of well-being, you see that if you pick, maternal mortality, infant mortality, heart disease, cancer, education, incarceration, pick one, any social outcome data you like, that the blue states have better social outcomes than the red states. Why? Because of this point that I'm trying to make. When you foster well-being, everything works better. And in fact, that is the only way we're going to get through climate change. So this is not a trivial question. We are at a place now, an existential crisis, where climate change is going to so dramatically change the Earth's environment that if we do not make changes and do not change the kind of choices we make, we may not get through.
So I guess what I was asking is that, you know, each person probably has their own sense of what is life affirming and compassionate, and I guess are there any examples of where it's hard to tell, like, is this more life affirming or is this more life affirming? Like, I'm imagining, first thing that comes to mind is a man whose job it is to he's a logger in the Amazon, right? And he's like, okay, I want to take care of my family, and what I know how to do is cut down trees. And so perhaps I'm imagining that for him, life affirming means like taking care of his family, which also results in like the destruction of the rainforest. So how to someone like that or and any other example, like how do you parse between these?
No, I understand what you're asking. Well, the answer to your question is the man never should have been put in that position in the first place, that he is in that position because the economic structure of the society of which he is a part is flawed. I mean, so he's just a factor in it. He is not controlling it. So he has to, I have to cut down trees because that's the only way I can feed my family. Well, if you're in that situation, you are in that situation because there is something fundamentally wrong with the social structure of your country. Because the country, I mean, you look at Bolsonaro and what he's doing to the Amazon, for instance, that is a conscious decision to destroy the Amazon so that a small group of people can get rich. That's it. If you change the policy and you made the Amazon a protected area, which no one was allowed to cut down, and if you cut it down, they put you in prison, this wouldn't be going on. Instead, what's happening is the Amazon is being destroyed. That, in turn, is going to alter the entire ecosystem of the Earth, which is going to cause countless misery and death all over the world. And it's all because a handful of people in Brazil and countries that are people that are invested in Brazil want to get rich.
And so what you're saying is that even if these people are not changing their choices, if we are changing our choices and we have enough people choosing differently, that it will impact those decision makers.
Yes. Well, look at the election that's coming up in November. We have one party which is trying to turn the country into a white supremacist, Christo-fascist, male-dominant anocracy. An anocracy is, it appears to function like a democracy, but in fact it does not. Russia is an anocracy. I mean, they have an election, but, you know, it's completely rigged, so it's not really an election. It's the illusion of an election. So we have one party that is doing that. We have another party which has got all kinds of flaws, but is nonetheless supportive of democracy. So you're going to go into the voting booth in November, and the question you have to ask yourself is, do I support democracy? Because if I support democracy, I have to vote Democratic. Okay, they're not perfect. They do things I don't all agree with, blah, 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 blah. But they do support democracy, whereas the Republican Party no longer supports democracy. So if I want democracy to survive in the United States, how do I vote? It's very straightforward. You know, once the important thing about this, Derek, is once you recognize that consciousness is causal and fundamental, and that these conscious choices that people make make a difference, everything gets very simple. You don't have, it's not complicated. Is this going to produce well-being? That's all. And if it's not, and I understand that different people understand well-being, that's okay. You are only required to make a decision based on your understanding at the moment you make the decision of what is the most compassionate, life-affirming, and fostering of well-being choice. And so you have a slightly different understanding than your neighbor, or maybe your position will change 6 months from now. None of that matters. The question is, every day you're making these little decisions, which decision are you choosing?
Okay, I love it. Let's get into this. Let's get into your 2050 and 2060 remote viewing research, because this is, I mean, the archaeology is fascinating, but I think the usefulness, the practicality of being able to look into the future and see what's coming. It just seems like the most useful thing in the world. What's coming our way?
In 25 words? Well, the big thing that's coming is that between 2040 and 2045, a confluence of trends come together to cause a really cataclysmic change. I'm not quite sure what they all are. I've begun to identify some of them. But in any case, the 2050s to 2060s talk about this change, and they describe themselves as being on the other side of it. So what is it? Well, I can identify certain parts of it. One is, by 2040, the end of the internal combustion engine. A number of countries in Europe and in Asia and some states in the United States have committed that by 2040 they will get internal combustion engines off their roads. So that's going to be a huge change. That's one. The other, I suspect, is we're going to have other pandemics, because the viruses and bacteria that cause the pandemics are mutating in order to accommodate the changed circumstances that are resulting from climate change. And so when I got started with this, I started in 1978. I left government in 76. And when I left government, you know, I had a young daughter, and I was very concerned about what life would be like for her. And I, because I had had access, I had held, you know, this argument that's going on now about Trump and the classified documents, I had held compartmentalized levels of clearance, security clearance. So I and most of the other people that were part of the geopolitical community, we thought in 1976 we were probably going to have a nuclear war. It just seemed inevitable, either from a mistake or from some stupidity by a politician. And so I was very concerned, well, if there's going to be a nuclear war, what's going to happen? And what kind of world will it be for my daughter Catherine and all the other kids? So that's what got me started in this project. Mm-hmm. And one of the first things that I got when I began doing this, and I originally got 4,000 people to remote view the future, the same day in the future, 2050. And now I'm doing it, I've gotten another couple thousand to do it for 2060. One of the first things that really struck me was that they said, no, there's not going to be a nuclear war. So I thought, well, that's great. So I said, well, then the world must be much safer. And they said to me, oh, no, the world is much more dangerous. And I said, really? Well, how can it possibly, if there's not a nuclear war, how can it be more dangerous? And they said, terrorism. Now, in 1978, when I first started doing this, the only terrorism was the Irish Protestant Catholic fight in Ireland. But, of course, now we know terrorism, particularly white male supremacy, MAGA terrorism, has become a huge problem in the United States. And it's a problem all over the world. So that I had not anticipated. I didn't understand it. When they said terrorism, 78, they started talking about this, 79, 80. I couldn't imagine what we have come to today. And then another thing I would say to them, well, talk to me about health care, because I'm been very interested for many, many years in health research, and I publish regularly on the subject, and I didn't know what was going to happen. And they said, well, it's radically different. Okay, I could get that. And then I said, but they said it's millions have died because there's going to be a series of pandemics. And I thought, pandemics? You know, what I was thinking of was Spanish flu in 1918. And they said, no, the first one will be a blood disease which will cross over from primates to humans and will kill millions of people. This was 1979 I first began hearing about this. And I went to a friend of mine who was the deputy director of National Institutes of Health. And I said to him, do you know anything about a blood disease that's going to cross over from primates to humans and that has the potential to kill millions of people? And he said to me, Stefan, whatever it is you're smoking, quit. Because no, that's just complete nonsense. And of course, in 81, AIDS emerged and it's killed 35 million people. And then we had SARS, and then we had H1N5, and then we have, now we're going through COVID, which has killed millions of people. And I believe we're going to have a number of other pandemics. And so I think that's one of the factors. This 2040.
As far as healthcare, any insight into technology advances or advances in the care of patients?
Yes. Well, the healthcare they describe is very different than healthcare today. First of all, it's much more focused on preventative medicine. Second of all, CRISPR technology has allowed us to begin to think about how you could eradicate certain kinds of diseases. One of the things that worries me is the creation of a second kind of hominid species, Homo superior. And that I think is going to happen. I think it's going to start out of Asia first. And the very wealthy are going to be the recipients of it. That it's going to involve gene lining, which means that it will pass on from one generation to the next. And I am very, very concerned about what would happen if you had a small cadre of Homo superior and what would happen to Homo sapien. Because if you look at that...
Suggesting this is the future reality?
This is the future reality, yes. And the evidence for that is already present. It's already going on.
And so, for example, when you parse through the 2060 data, how does that show up? Like, how do you come to understand there's a new species or a...
They talk about there being other beings that are like humans but not human.
So this could theoretically also be extraterrestrials or other type of...
No, I don't get a lot of extraterrestrial stuff. I think extraterrestrials... I wrote a novel about this because I couldn't objectively prove everything I wanted to say. So I wrote it in a novel form, a novel called Awakening, which is a novel about aliens and consciousness. I think what's happening, and the reason we're seeing more and more contacts, sightings with unidentified aerial phenomena, is that they're watching us in the way cultural anthropologists watched primitive tribes. That is, from a distance and without interfering too much. And I suspect that they're doing that because every culture, no matter where it is in the universe, that develops technology gets to a point where they either are destroyed by the technology or they awaken to the fact that consciousness is causal and fundamental, and they make different technological choices. And the question that I suspect the ETs are watching is, are we going to destroy ourselves, or are we going to wake up and change all the choices we make? It would mean completely different technologies, for instance. You would get rid of things, anything that polluted. You'd be putting all your money into the development of technologies which augmented and supported well-being instead of destroying it. You can just see, not a single Republican voted for this climate bill that just passed, the bill that Biden's going to sign, hopefully this week or next. But not a single Republican voted for climate change remediation. And so we have about a third of the country who really just don't get it. And the question is, do they prevail, or do those who do understand that we need to change the technologies? And I think this culminates by 2040. 2040 is only 18 years in the future. We're not talking about far in the future. I mean, you're going to be around and see it. So what's going to happen? We're going to make different kinds of choices. As I said, the 2050s or 2060s say they're on the other side of it. The 2060s much more than the 2050s. So whatever it is, it takes a number of years to get through. I think climate change is going to be part of it. We're going to have three major migrations in the United States away from coastlines, both sea and river, because of too much water. We're going to have a migration out of the Southwest because of lack of water. Look at what's happening to the Colorado River, Lake Powell, Lake Mead, the Great Salt Lake. The rise in temperature, so you're not going to have enough water, and you're going to have, I'm looking at papers now in the climate, the academic climate literature, which are talking about areas like Phoenix may have 100 days a year when the temperature's over 110, 115, 120. And I can tell you from doing an archaeological project in Egypt that at 114, the Bedouin stop work and go back into their tents.
Good idea.
So how you're going to live in a city which has a temperature of 120 for days on end, I'm not sure how that's possible. And the third is going to be out of the central states because of not only temperature rise, but also a cataclysmic, really catastrophic weather events like tornadoes that destroy towns completely. I was in Oklahoma a few years ago, and I was speaking as a keynote of a conference, and afterwards they had a dinner party, and I was seated next to a Republican city council or county commissioner, I guess he was. And I said to him, you know, what are you doing about climate change? Make conversation. He said, well, I don't believe in climate change. I said, really? Well, what does concern you? And he said, well, what really concerns me is how many times do you rebuild a town? And I said, what? And he said, well, we've got a town in my county that's been destroyed twice by climate, tornadoes. Wow. And the question is, how many times do you rebuild? Or do you just give up and go somewhere else? And he said, that's what worries me. Mm. And I said, and you don't think of that as climate change? And he didn't. But anyway, so we're going to have three major migrations that are going to involve millions of people. I spoke at a medical conference, and I made this point, and I said to them, to these doctors in the audience, I said, if you live in a small town or a small city, and 50,000 people descend on your city as basically refugees, and about 11 whatever percent of them are diabetics, where are you going to get all the insulin? Where are you going to get the treatments that you need to get for people who have cancer or things like that? And a bunch of the doctors came up to me afterwards and said, we never thought about that. We couldn't possibly handle that. I said, well, where are these people going to go to the bathroom? Oh, I said, where are they going to sleep? You're going to put them in all the high school gyms? Where are they going to get food? This to a doctor who came from a town of about 3,500 people. He said, I have no idea. We couldn't possibly handle that.
Right. Where are the ideal North American geographic zones in this situation?
Well, I'm in one of them. That's why I'm here. And that's the Pacific Northwest. And the other one is the Northeast. They're going to get, in the Pacific, where Pacific Northwest, where I am, we're going to get warmer and wetter. So we'll get warmer, but not outrageously warmer. And we'll get wetter, which is okay. Whereas, for instance, if you look at a city like Tucson or Phoenix or Santa Fe, I don't know what those people are going to do, particularly Arizona. I mean, I just don't know what people in Phoenix are going to, I don't know how they're going to survive. 120 degrees for 100 days a year? I mean, come on. How are you going to survive if you are dependent on the Colorado River, for instance, for your water, as many states are? What are you going to do as the Colorado dries up and the Lake Powell dries up and Lake Mead dries up? What's Salt Lake City going to do as the Great Salt Lake dries up and the toxins that they have allowed to get into the water and the other just naturally occurring toxins, as the dust blows on the dry areas where the lake formerly was, and they're already seeing people with increased problems with lung difficulties as a result of the toxins blowing around in the air. So what are they going to do? How are they going to survive? We're going to have massive change.
Before I forget, I wanted to ask, because we were talking about ETs. Have you or anyone done remote viewing experiments or projects to look at ET civilizations?
No, Ingo Swann and Harold Sherman did a remote viewing of Mars, Mercury, and Jupiter, which all turned out to be correct. But no, I haven't done it because I can't prove it. I wrote a novel, Awakening, based on, I've been involved with ET studies going back to the 50s. I mean, Donald Kehoe, if that name means anything. Donald Kehoe introduced me to the whole idea of ETs. That was about 1955. And I've been interested in studying it ever since. But I can't, you know, you can't prove stuff. Now we can see sightings that are occurring. But remote viewing what another culture would be like, how would you know whether it was actual remote viewing or just fantasy? And I can't prove it. So as I said, I'm a data person. So if I can't objectively verify it, I'm not that interested in it.
Okay, fair enough. Okay, so I'm curious about when you get this information from the 2060, and so how do you, well, you said, okay, there's new beings and it might be this new species of human. Like, how are you parsing this data, or how do you sort of sort through the data to find your...
Well, how do I analyze it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, for anybody that's interested who's watching this show, go to academia.edu and search on my name, and all my papers are up there, or at least a lot of them are up there. And you can look at the archaeological work and I'm doing the same thing. It's basically the same thing intelligence organizations do, or investigative reporters. I ask a lot of people, and what I'm looking for is where there is consensus. Because I know where there is consensus, there is likely to be a higher probability of accuracy. You know, if suddenly outside of wherever you are right now, you heard a huge explosion and you ran out, and there were a bunch of people standing out in the street, and you went up to them, and what would you do? Well, you'd go up to them individually, pull them aside so the others couldn't overhear, and you'd say, "What did you see? What did you see? What did you see?" Now, they wouldn't all agree. We know from research that, for instance, a woman is more likely to get the color of a car right, and the man is a lot more liable to get the make and model of the car right. So there are biases that are built in. But if you look at the consensus, we know from the research, I've been doing this now for so many years, in all kinds of circumstances, solving crimes, archaeology, just all sorts of stuff. We know that about 35 to 40% of the material cannot be evaluated. That doesn't mean it's wrong, it just means you can't evaluate it. If I said to you, the pilot of the plane that crashed was thinking of his children as the plane went down, well, unless he sent out a message before he died, there's no way to know. So it might be right, maybe he was thinking of his children, but you can't know. So about 35% typically you can't evaluate. Of the remaining percentage, we expect to see between 75 and 85% of it be correct or partially correct. Now, what do I mean by partially correct? Well, if I said the bearded man interviewing me with the gray shirt, and in fact it's a blue shirt, so gray would be wrong, but it would be partially correct in every other respect. So we expect to see 75 to 85% be either rated correct or partially correct. And so what I'm doing is going through the data and concept by concept. And I'm rating, first of all, I'm seeing where they agree, where the consensus agrees. I also look for low a priori observations, because things that you don't expect that come out of the blue are often correct. For instance, if I ask you to describe a sunken ship and you talk to me about anchors, well, it's a ship. Of course it has anchors. But if you tell me that in the wardroom they had a Picasso painting, I don't expect to hear that. I don't expect to see that. So that turns out to be likely to be correct. It's an odd observation, low a priori. So I'm looking for consensus. I'm paying attention to low a priori. I also, in this experiment now, the 2060 work, I have 1,000 people who also did it, not on the basis of remote viewing or opening to non-local consciousness, but I asked them to do their best intellectual assessment of the future. And I'm going to look at whether, when people do what they think of as their best intellectual assessment, rational assessment, are they in fact fantasizing, or are they actually doing it rationally and intellectually? And if so, how is that different or the same as the people who are deliberately doing it using non-local consciousness? And so I don't know yet.
And that's just sort of looking and extrapolating from current trends, predicting the future from current.
Well, then what I look at what the remote viewers are telling me. It's only 18 years in the future. And I do a daily web publication called Schwartz Report. You may know about it, www.schwartzreport.net. And I track trends which are shaping the future. And so I look for things which the remote viewers have told me are going to happen, and I try to see, is this in fact probable, because there is already a trend that has started to do that.
What are you most excited about for the future, given the data you've experienced?
Excited about? That's not the right question.
What are you looking forward to? Or,
well, what I think is going to happen is that by 2050, 2060 particularly, it's going to be a very different country. One of the things that I've asked people is, does the United States still exist? And if so, what is its place in the world? And in general, what they tell me is, yes, it still exists, but it has the same form, but real power has devolved to the states and collections of states. And you can see this in the red-blue schism, what I call the Great Schism trend that's going on in the United States right now. I mean, just look at what's happening with the overturn of Roe. I mean, you can already see what's going on there. Health care for women in red states is going to severely decline compared to the health care for women in blue states. So I can already see that. I can see these trends, like the decision that's being made by countries to eliminate the internal combustion engine. So I can see that what they describe about the 2060s is probably correct, because I can already see that it started. Again, I'm a data person, so I'm looking for objectively verifiable data which either confirms or denies these trends. And the reason I chose 2050 and 2060 is because if you get too far out, you can't understand what they're saying. I can give you specific examples, but basically, you don't want to get too far ahead because, even in, say, 1925, if I'd told you that you could wear something on your wrist that would allow you to talk to somebody anywhere in the world, what possible interpretation would you make of that? So I don't want to get too far out. I want to be able to see the trends that are emerging within the time frame that I'm looking at, so I can see whether they're likely to be correct or not.
I know it's time for us to wrap. I have loads more questions, but maybe my final question would be, let's say someone is interested in working on a project or starting an organization or an entrepreneur that wants to help make things better for humanity. We've already talked about the daily quotidian choices, but what sort of projects would you suggest could take advantage of the data that you have that would sort of help us progress?
Oh yeah, well that's part of the reason I did it, because I wanted to be able to say to people who were investing and starting things, startups, these are the places you want to concentrate. So if you called me up and you said, I'm an investor and I've got $20 million I'd like to put into something, what do you think I should do? I would say, well, a significant percentage of it should go into education, because Americans, a significant percentage of Americans can't read past the sixth grade level. They are enumerate. They can't calculate a percentage. And they can't read a complicated, anything that's above what a sixth grader could read and understand it. I would say we already can see the Chinese are now surpassing us in innovation, because of the poor education that we have. I mean, you've got one party in this country, the Republicans, who want to indoctrinate people about history and slavery, they don't want to teach it. That is, they don't want to teach the facts. So I would say, and I just saw on 60 Minutes last night about this chap who started the Hope Project in Chicago, who's giving millions of dollars. He's going to eventually get 30,000 kids who couldn't normally find the money to go to college. He's going to pay for their college, their dorm, their food, everything. Now, who's to say which one of those people might turn out to be another Einstein or another Jonas Salk or another, another Picasso or whatever. I mean, pick whatever you like. I mean, you know, all those 30,000 kids he's going to finance in college? Wow. I mean, who knows who those people are going to turn into? So I would say to someone, I would put money in education, because as the company that you're trying to create develops, you want to be able to hire high-quality people who are well-educated and who live in a fact-based reality, not in some fantasy reality. I would also say, if I were doing this, when I look, for instance, at the transformation from internal combustion to EVs, electric-powered vehicles, you know, most of it's being discussed today as a continuation of what I would call the gas station model. That is, we're hearing all this conversation about putting in charging stations and then all the battery problems and blah, 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 blah that attends that model. Well, I would be putting money into, and I would say to somebody, I would be putting money into roads which can charge the vehicles as they drive over them. And this is beginning. There are already some projects. There's a project at Cornell, for instance, that's going on where they're looking at how do you create roadways which charge the batteries of the vehicles that drive over them.
Didn't I hear you say something about there's a box that goes in the cars in the homes that powers the cars?
Well, that's an example of what I was saying earlier about you don't understand. One of the things that the 2050s and 2060s tell me is that there's some kind of box that you buy. It gets warm but not hot, and it provides power. Now, is that fusion? Maybe. Is that something else I don't even know about? Possibly. The problem is, it's too far out. I can't understand, and I can't find anything currently going on that would look like that. I mean, cold fusion is the one possibility. I've also seen some stuff about magnetism. Maybe that's it. I don't know. So I can't, there are things that I just can't evaluate. But what I can get is that everybody talks about these electric vehicles. And so the question, it seems to me, is how are you going to power them? And do I have to stop and charge? Boy, that'd be a really, wow. Or do they charge as you drive over them? How about long-distance trucks? I would suggest to somebody that they look at renovating that trains. Because if I look at the data and what they're saying, I mean, for instance, the viewers say people don't travel as much. There aren't as many airplanes flying. And of course, if you look at the research, what you see is that the pollution that comes out of jet aircraft is a big problem. So I would be looking at, could you renovate the railroad system and make high-speed trains such as they have in Japan and China? Because if you've ever been to Japan or China, for instance, or even Europe, but particularly Japan or China, you see a kind of train doesn't exist. The average train in the passenger train in the United States averages 56 miles an hour. The average train in Japan that carries passengers is about 230 miles an hour. So the difference between a short air flight and a high-speed train is very minimal.
Yeah.
Well, I would be cool. looking at that. I would be looking at the CRISPR issue, I think, is a very big issue. I would be looking at that. I would be looking at is there something that we can do that can help people make different choices so that they don't cause, I mean, the number of obese Americans, it's so large, it's like 60% or something. You know, when you go to Europe, for instance, or you go to Japan or China, one of the things that really stands out for you is how much the Americans stand out because they are so obese. And obviously it's destroying their health and, bad, you know, heart disease, diabetes 2, blah, 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 and all that. So I would be looking at how can I train people, how can I educate people so that they make different choices. Clearly, we are not going to be able to continue chemical industrial monoculture as we have been doing. That isn't going to survive. So I would be looking at investing in how can I create the growing of food without having to transport it long distances? And again, you can begin to see research along those lines.
Well, this is really fantastic. And, you know, I appreciate your data-driven approach. I appreciate all the little anecdotes. You've had such an interesting journey along the way. And, you know, this is really helpful for people to start to have a nice concrete conceptualization of where we're headed. So, just really appreciate your work and your time today. And
my pleasure.
Thanks so much for being a guest.
My pleasure. We'll do it again. You take care.
All right. Thanks, Stefan.
Bye-bye.